Before we get started, I want to just tell you about a brand new series I've just launched of bite-sized episodes, The 9 Parallels of Positive Leadership. It is packed with practical tips and techniques from my incredible guest that you can start using today. So if you're looking to build your confidence, connect with your purpose, and energize and inspire your team, The 9 Parallels of Positive Leadership is for you. Episodes 1 and 2 are out now.
Can we think about identity as a tool to connect? Inside me, I have a human identity, a female identity, an athletic identity. There are so many ways that I can connect to another human being, no matter who they are on the planet, across race, class, religion, ethnicity. And if I start from that place, we can see ourselves in each other.
Hello and welcome to Positive Leadership, the podcast that helps you grow as an individual, as a leader, and ultimately as a global citizen. One thing I've learned over the years is that our well-being depends on human connection. When we take time to listen to each other's stories, we can begin to build authentic connections. And it's our connections that help us survive and thrive. My guest today, Jacqueline Novogratz, the founder and CEO of the nonprofit venture Acumen, is a visionary leader who has dedicated her career to connecting with other people, standing with the poor, and building tribes to address global poverty and social injustice. I was really excited to speak with her about the innovative approaches she's developed building businesses for people who've been overlooked, taking philanthropy investing long-term, 10 to 20 years. In this episode, she also shared great insights on the power of storytelling and where to begin when you're writing your own personal story. Jacqueline's recent book, Manifesto for Moral Revolution, is an absolute must-read for anyone eager to build a better world. There's so much wisdom in this episode. It's really one of my favorites. Hope you enjoy it. Make sure you stay with us until the very end. So Jacqueline, really great to have you on the podcast. A very warm welcome in a cold New York, I think, where you are.
Jean-Philippe, thank you so much for that warm welcome. I really appreciate it, and I'm happy to be here.
Super. So let's get started with some of your roots, Jacqueline. I think you came from a large Catholic family with six siblings. And growing up, you moved around a lot as your dad was serving in the military. So what kind of values were foundational to you and your family growing up? And what was it like you actually with this constant moving around as a child?
Yes, I grew up in an immigrant family. My grandmother came to the United States and was the eldest of six sisters. And they all moved to a small town outside Allentown, Pennsylvania, blue-collar town. And so I think their values really dominated our family's culture, values that start with family and and therefore the idea of duty, of showing up for each other, of accepting diversity within this large group. And I would say of hard work, for sure, the immigrant. Yeah. My father would always say hard work equals success. And then something that came from my mother's side as a woman who grew up with a single mom. Her dad died when she was a year and a half in New York City. I think she brought aspiration into our family as well. And some of my aunts and uncles say my mom taught the rest of the family what it meant to be American, which I think is connected to aspiration for better and for worse. And what it meant to move around all the time, because my father was in the military, which reinforced a sense of duty and showing up, was you had to learn very quickly how to adapt, how to meet new friends. And something I never got very good at was then saying goodbye to those friends very quickly in an age well before social media. So it was very difficult to stay connected once you left.
It must have been super hard to have a sense of belonging somehow, right? In terms of those communities where you stay maybe a couple of years and then you move on and try to reset all of that all over again as a child.
It's funny. I actually think it becomes a superpower of a certain kind of military kid. You definitely have those kids that grew up in a family of constant moving that want never to move again. In our family, my mother, I came from a tribe.
Yep.
And my mother was so great at building a sense of tribe that no matter where we went, we had each other. And so I actually think I grew up internalizing almost being at home everywhere and nowhere, but always tethered to these six siblings of mine and this extended family.
Yeah. You know, recently I was speaking to someone I think you know well, Rita Roy, CEO of the MasterCard Foundation, who comes from a very multicultural family as well. You know, she was born in Malaysia and came to the States as a teen, and she spoke about the value of having multiple identities, both inherited and adopted as well. I know she learned early on that part of her job with a small J was to find ways to connect with people on things which are intrinsically human. So my question is it something that you experience yourself, that kind of multiple identities in a way? And can you talk about this theme of multiple identities and the way it helps you grow in your journey, both from the perspective of improving your collaborations in the work environment and your ability on top of that, of course, to serve others? So have you gone through that process yourself?
Well, I actually grew up and came from a family that did not have multiple identities. Everyone in this big family shared Austrian heritage, Catholic, a lot of shared identity. But for some reason, maybe connected to the fact that my father went to Vietnam, I was always fascinated with the rest of the world. I was always fascinated with the fact that my dad was in Vietnam and he worked at an orphanage there in his spare time. And therefore, I'd hear these stories of the children and wonder why their reality was so different from mine, just by virtue of where they were born. It was the era of the song, "It's a Small World After All."
Yeah.
And I bought in 150%. I wanted to know that world. I wanted to love that world. And if I'm really honest, Jean-Philippe, parts of my own identity that came with the immigrant identity gave me a sense of shame. My grandmother wore black lace-up shoes and these cotton house dresses, and she wasn't like the grandmothers of the kids I went to school with who took them on holiday. I'd never been on an airplane. And I think it took me a number of years to integrate the power of that identity. And now, ironically, that grandmother, Stella, lives inside of me, probably has helped me connect in very deep ways because I literally see her face and her hands in so many rural African women I have worked with over these past 40 years. Because what she shared with them and their identity was that idea of hard work, of faith, of loss. She lost three children before they were five, of poverty. And yet of a deep intrinsic dignity. I'd say the person that has most influenced me about how identity works, and I have assumed many, many identities as I've grown through this world, is Amin Maalouf, the Lebanese writer, who he actually talks about a hierarchy of identities and says that we all have these many, many identities, some of them imposed on us from birth, and some of us, as Rita said, that we choose, that we take on. And so that now in my identity is, yes, raised Catholic, now much more ecumenical, yes, raised American, now global citizen. They all exist within me. And that when one part of our identity is threatened, it rises to the top. And too often it becomes our only identity. And that's where we get ourselves into trouble. So I would say I started off more with a narrower identity and one that has grown into much more of a kaleidoscopic one that has been one of the greatest gifts of working and I would say dancing across the globe in the way that my work has given me the opportunity to do.
Your first job out of university was on Wall Street as an analyst at Chase Manhattan Bank. In one of your podcast interviews, you talked about this almost unreal interview where I believe you started the interview by saying that you are not actually interested in having a career in the banking sector, and you are yet applying for that job at Chase Manhattan Bank. So why did you interview for the job in the first place, and how did you manage to actually get hired, I think, with such a bad start?
Sure. So going back to the immigrant upbringing, I think it plants the seeds of entrepreneurialism in you. And in our family, it was very clear that if you wanted any aspirational good, you had to earn the money yourself. And that included going to university. My parents wanted us, expected us to go to good universities, but they didn't have the income to send us there. And so I worked my whole life, both to get into school and then to pay my way through university. And at the end of those 4 years, I said to my parents, I've never really had a vacation. I've worked throughout, and I want to take a year off now to do what all the other kids have been able to do in their lives, and then I'll go to school. And my parents thought that was a very bad idea, but they knew who I was, and if they told me I couldn't do it, that would be exactly what I would do. And so they used great psychology and said, it's a good idea, but just do us a favor and at least go through the interview process. I thought that was fair. And so at that time at my school, they had boxes with the names of companies and the kinds of majors they would accept. And so Chase Manhattan Bank accepted foreign affairs and economics degrees. I had both. And so I put my resume dutifully in the box. And so then I got the job interview. And then I got asked the one question I was not prepared for, which was, why do you want to be a banker? Constitutionally, I'm incapable of lying. And so I just told him the truth. And I just said, I actually don't want to be a banker. My parents made me do this interview. And so I'm really sorry. And he said, you know, that is just too bad then, Jacqueline, because if you got this job, you would be in 40 countries over the next 3 years.
And that'll get you thinking.
Well, Jean-Philippe, as I explained, all I wanted to do my whole life was travel around the world. So I literally said, do you think we might start this interview over? And he just smiled at me and was like, sure. And I left the room. I knocked on the door again.
Literally
got up. I left the room. I took a deep breath. I knocked on the door. I introduced myself. And he said, so tell me, Jacqueline, why do you want to be a banker? And I said, ever since I was 6 years old, all I ever wanted to do was be a banker.
I would love to have been a fly on the wall in that interview. Despite getting off to a bad start, the guy across the desk from Jacqueline recognized that she had a lot of spirit and that she wanted to understand the political and economic realities of countries around the world and that she wanted to contribute. A few years later, she was introduced to the work of Muhammad Yunus, the famous Bangladeshi social entrepreneur, banker, economist, and civil society leader, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 for founding the Grameen Bank and pioneering the concept of microcredit and microfinance. And that got her thinking about her journey and what she could do differently in her life.
At the time, I was in Brazil with Chase, and I would spend my weekends in the favelas seeing low-income people who had so much initiative but couldn't even walk through the doors of the bank. And I was thinking about, couldn't Chase lend to those individuals? Which my boss did not think was such a great idea. But I came across a tiny article about the barefoot banker, Dr. Muhammad Yunus, who was an economist in Bangladesh, as you said, Jean-Philippe, who had the insight that very low-income people would pay back if they got access to credit. And so he made $30 loans to very, very low income women and saw that 100% of them did pay back. And from that humble beginning, he started the Grameen Bank, which today has lent billions of dollars and catalyzed a movement where I believe there are microfinance institutions in 100 countries.
Yeah.
Leadership is hard. And at age 83, Dr. Yunus has recently been sentenced to 6 months in prison in Bangladesh. And so I've really reflected on the loneliness of the road of leadership and the resilience and the persistence that it takes and how being part of a community that can actually stand up for you really matters. And it's exciting to see people around the world standing up for Dr. Yunus today because he's contributed so much to how we think about economics.
No, absolutely. And fully agree with you. And can you go back to that moment in a way and how much that moment, that article, but also, of course, your experience in the favelas in Brazil and some more decided you to, well, to move to a different path?
It was a moment. The moment of seeing what he had done and then learn that Ilabat in India, Abed also in Bangladesh, and Michaela Walsh in Women's World Banking, that there were four or five examples by then, this is way back in 1985, were operating and that I could be part of that. After making a very strong plea to my boss, as I said, for Chase to take that on and failing at that, I decided then I needed to at least try. And that was the moment for me that ends me up first in the Ivory Coast, Côte d'Ivoire, in Abidjan, where I could be an ambassador to women who were creating these microfinance organizations, really the work that I wanted to learn how to do. But it was early, Jean-Philippe, in this kind of international nonprofit world. And so when I landed, there was real no support system. The women who I had gone to work with, not only didn't ask for me, but they clearly didn't want me to be there. And to say that I failed is such an understatement.
Yeah, I like you to share more because I know it was a painful experience for you. But just to give our listeners some context, you are 25 years old, if I'm not mistaken, right? When you landed, 25. I guess was one of, beyond Brazil, it was really one of your first trip, maybe the first one in Africa first as well. And so you had to be incredibly brave to kind of, you know, assume to be a leader. So tell us more about the characters in that female community in Abidjan. And as they saw you basically standing up one day, showing up and telling them what to do, how did that work and what happened then?
Well, it was complex in that I was 25. I didn't know a soul. And I certainly didn't know what I was in for. The three female leaders who were in a way vying for that same position, and I didn't understand that, were extremely powerful and extremely strong. I actually didn't go in to be, quote unquote, a leader, but I did go in with this idea that I was going to help women build these microfinance organizations. And when I learned was that there really weren't any microfinance organizations, but there were a lot of really strong women that were talking about what they wanted to do. My first job was to run a 52-country conference for women. And it was very clear that anything that I tried to do was not going to get done, and I didn't understand how to ask even. And the lesson for me was that I didn't come first just to listen. I didn't come to hear what others felt even about me. I came with this idea that I will show them my worth by
what to do,
creating this incredible opportunity. And it really backfired. And in short, I learned that, you know, I went to save the world and discovered that most people don't want saving.
So, In essence, Jacqueline, because all of us, hopefully in a way, go through some tough experiences in our life, professional, personal life as well, where we learn so much. What was the biggest learning you had out of this fiasco?
Two lessons. One, start with listening, immersing, understand who other people are without coming in with your own agenda.
Yeah.
The second thing is a lesson that I've learned for more and more over the years, which is real relationships acknowledge that there's good and bad in all of us. And in a way, like I see sometimes today with so many young people, I felt a lot of shame for many of the American policies. And it was the 80s, the greed of America at the time. And I think when I went, I thought I would find all good, you know, the idea of African community, et cetera. And when I became effective was when I could acknowledge, going back to identity, Jean-Philippe, that in my own culture, there were some really amazing things, as well as parts that gave me shame. And to be effective in any other culture, could I approach it as I would approach a full human being? With the good and the bad. And the more I could do that without judgment, the more effective I would be.
That's the key, without judgment. It's so hard to do, so hard. And keeping that humility, right, all the time. So, you know, I think it's a very interesting discussion. Recently in my podcast, I had someone else, you may know, I think, Jacqueline, Angeline Mureminois, CEO of CAMFET.
She's amazing.
And she grew up in a poor family in Zimbabwe where girls didn't get the opportunity to continue their studies, which is a common issue still in many, many African cities and places and villages. So because of her great work in primary school, Angeline was selected by the CAMFET Foundation, which funded her high school studies. And then she did so well over the years that eventually she joined the CAMFET team and she became their CEO. And an amazing story showing the importance of female role models in Africa. So Jacqueline, back to your life now. Again, after the experience, you talked about Côte d'Ivoire, then talked about Kenya. I think you also worked on some of the microfinance banks in Rwanda. Along with someone who was very special to you, I think, Felicula. You envision a world in which women could have greater control over their lives. What were your aims and ambitions at the time setting up the bank, and what did you take away from that experience, again, with women in particular, of shaping that initiative?
And bravo you, Jean-Philippe, for interviewing these strong women like Rita and Angeline. It's exciting because I think it is a moment for women's leadership. Also, take you back to 1986 when I was first invited to Rwanda. And so this was my first invitation in rather than me being imposed on. Big importance.
Big step.
Rwanda had just changed Napoleonic code, which put women in the same category as children and the mentally ill. And so until 1986, women couldn't open a bank account without their husband's permission and signature. And so we were really starting at a point where there was no economic opportunity for those women. It was mostly a barter economy. And what I learned very quickly, again, not coming with an orientation of women's rights or any of that, but just seeing the reality by immersing now and paying attention, that women wouldn't speak in the room if a man was in the room. But if the man was not in the room, we would have extraordinary conversations. And so our initial mission was quite simple, that we were going to improve the economic condition of women and create more opportunity for future generations. Like I've seen now as someone who has founded multiple organizations, when you start, you understand conceptually what it is that you are doing, but you don't understand it viscerally until you actually begin and start to recognize what you're building.
Doing it.
And so we wanted to build this new generation that had economic opportunity and could be a real participants in their own nation. 40 years later, Duta Dembere, that bank, is a force in Rwanda. And equally important, and it's the power of institutions, the women who came through it and their daughters are playing leading roles in the economy. And that That is powerful.
It's powerful. It's an amazing legacy as well you built, I mean, through your leadership, I guess, to encourage that, to get that to happen.
Well, I don't think it was my leadership. I think it was, in a way, thanks to learning by being banged on the head in Abidjan, that the only way we would succeed was that if this were truly a Rwandan institution. And so I didn't found it. I co-founded it with five Rwandan women. We were very deliberate in ensuring that I didn't get too far ahead of anybody, because this was all I was doing and they had very rich lives. And so by the time I left, it was theirs. And when I go back, no one even knows who I am.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean by leadership. It's what leadership is all about, is actually getting that to happen without you being involved anymore, but being somehow an inspiration for that movement to happen. Talk about inspiration, Jacqueline. I was, as I said in my introduction, deeply inspired by your book. So I'm going to read just a few lines. I know you've got the book handy as well. Your book, again, called The Manifesto for Moral Evolution. It's a part of the book when you call for moral evolution that helps us reimagine and reform technology, business, and politics. You're right. What is needed, whether you are working in high-tech or in low-income communities, is the moral imagination to ensure that our future solutions and institutions are inclusive and sustainable. You know, in my own life, with my foundation, Live for Good, a much smaller one than Acumen, we are unleashing the nine pearls of positive leadership with our young impact entrepreneurs from all walks of life. And one of those pearls is how to develop your environmental and social consciousness. So my question back to you is, what are the other pivotal experiences or influences contributed to shaping your own awareness, understanding, and commitment to environmental and social issues altogether?
Well, most surely, and ironically, Chase was the beginning of seeing a world that was constructed for one class of people to the exclusion of others. The work in Rwanda especially helped me to understand how low-income people are often invisible to policymakers and to corporations. I also think Rwanda helped me understand that the poor live in what I would call a political economy more than a market economy. What do I mean by that? In a market economy, we assume that everyone can interact with some degree of fairness, decide whether they like the price or not, et cetera. In a political economy, everyone has their hands involved in how things work. In building Duta Dembere, the bank, I learned very quickly what the status quo was, that it wasn't just that women didn't want to borrow because they were afraid of borrowing from an institution, but their husbands had a role in saying whether they could borrow. I was confronted by many of the village priests who felt that it was unethical for us to charge interest, even though moneylenders were charging 10 times as much as we were charging.
Yeah,
I learned that government officials, in some cases, were quite threatened about the idea of a women's bank. And on and on and on.
That
the status quo that had a role to play in the lives of poor people went far beyond each individual's capacity to change their lives. And so that at the heart of solving problems of poverty had to be not just seeing how much income somebody earned, but whether they had the dignity to make their own decisions, to make their own choices, to know that they could contribute. And that was fundamental in shaping my entire philosophy for starting Acumen and for the work that I've been doing. On the environmental side, I think I came more slowly to that understanding. And I was thinking about why recently. In 1991, a boyfriend and I went to Borneo to do this three-week crazy trek in the rainforest. Yep. He was a conservationist and really part of the conservation movement. I cared at that point. It was very clear. I was all about poor people and poverty.
Poor people.
And we fought the whole time. People, planet, people, planet.
One or the other.
One or the other. And and it was incontrovertible that we were in the rainforest and we didn't hear any animals. It was the beginning of my opening of my consciousness that palm oil plantations were thriving because precious rainforest was being taken down. But at that point, Jean-Philippe, the environmental movement was dominated by and populated by mostly more privileged men. And I didn't see that kind of power or money going behind finding smart solutions to poverty. And so I think part of me felt that it was my responsibility to find ways to use markets to solve problems of poverty. And I'd figure out the environmental stuff along the way. That was a big pivotal point for me of this is really important. And I'm going to focus here so that people aren't completely confused by what we do.
I'd like to just pause there to pick up on what Jacqueline says about how solving the problem of poverty is not just about how much money someone has or doesn't have, but it's about having the dignity to make their own decisions. It's an important point, and it underlines Jacqueline's deep-level empathy and her ability to listen. Empathy and active listening are essential components of building meaningful connections. By taking the time to understand others' perspectives and actively listening to their thoughts and feelings, you can build stronger relationships based on trust and mutual respect. When you're working in change and you're building businesses for people who've been overlooked, your job sometimes becomes creating enough openness and demonstrating how much that you are listening. And that give them the permission to tell you the stories that they need to tell so that you can actually help solve their problems together. So a wonderful transition into the birth of Acumen, Jacqueline. You started, of course, talking about Acumen that you created in 2001, your vision being a world based on dignity, which is the word you've been already using a couple of times. Well, every human being has the same opportunity. So rather than giving philanthropy away, which is a way as well to contribute, by the way, you invest in companies and change makers in the world. In the early days, you had to work out how you are going to operate, be it for profit or non-profit, and you settled on a new idea called patient capital. So I'd love you to unpack that idea of patient capital for our listeners. You know, we had one episode about a year ago with Sir Ronald Cohen, that you may know, who is a wonderful gentleman as well, who's done so much on social innovation. But tell us more about patient capital and the way you kind of articulate it.
So patient capital, especially for creating markets where they haven't existed or worked for low-income people, is essentially taking philanthropy and investing long-term, 10 to 20 years, in entrepreneurs who are focused on solving problems of poverty. We invest as equity and debt, but primarily as equity.
Yep.
Take positions in companies and accompany those companies with management assistance, with using our, another jargon, our social capital, our networks, our access to enable them to build. We measure the impact, not only the returns. Any money that comes back gets reinvested in innovation for the poor. And that is patient capital. 20 years after starting, we've seen not only that we can leverage every dollar we invest with another $6 as these companies become more commercial, but we've also seen the impact that about $120 million has resulted in a half a billion people whose lives are changed.
That's amazing. I'd like us to peel a little bit more the onion, if you don't mind, Jacqueline, on this, on the way it works, actually. You know, and I'm going to start with a position of reality, which is based on the latest UN report on the 2030 UN SDG goals, progress, right? After decades of steady progress, it's quite sad to see that there are more than 575 million people below the poverty level in the world, and 148 million kids with stunted growth and 45 million below 5 years old were suffering from wasting. So with Acumen, you've decided to fight poverty by, again, empowering, growing, funding entrepreneurs who tackle some of the most challenging issues lived by people, again, earning less than $3 a day. So my question to you is, because it's super hard, it's not a science, it's not an art either, it's probably in between. How do you source and pick the right entrepreneurs to focus on the right issues to alleviate poverty? How do you make a bet on a change maker who can truly change the world and who can really make it happen? Not just having a dream, but who has it in him, in her, to make it happen?
In a way, this goes back to the tribe of Acumen, which is a tribe of pragmatic idealists. It comes down to character, Jean-Philippe. And it comes down to the humility that we will not know the particular intervention that will make change. What our superpower is finding those entrepreneurs who have vision, resilience, persistence, who are able to hold opposing ideas in tension. And so they don't just talk about profit and purpose. They have shown us how they have to make the brutally difficult decisions to enable that balance, knowing that sometimes they will choose purpose and have to find their way over a much longer period of time to get to profit. You show us those types of characters, we'll go on the crazy journey with them to solve a big problem of poverty. And along the way, learn with them and start to build the ecosystem by investing in other entrepreneurs who come along.
And where do you find them? How do you find them?
Well, now it's a lot easier because Acumen is big.
Yes, of course.
In the beginning, it was literally like needles in haystacks.
Yeah.
In our very first 6 months, I hired these two interns. They looked at 700 organizations and they came up with zero. And so a very wise man, and this is to all startup entrepreneurs, a very wise man said to me, Jacqueline, you're looking for perfection. Choose mediocrity, but just move.
Just start.
Just start. Yeah. And so I did. And he was right. The first one.
You learn. Yeah. It
failed.
First batch, and the second one, the third. And
we learned. It took a lot of stress off.
Yeah.
And then we started to make real change.
Yeah. Let's go back a bit, Jacqueline, on this connection again between social environment issues. I think you attended the last COP28, and because I saw you sharing some of your reflections. So you said that you saw countries and organizations recognizing that renewable energy must be the future and that we must create green pathways out of poverty and markets to make the global transition to clean energy become possible. So at the time, we are still 2 billion people rely on polluting fuels to cook, where 660 million still don't have electricity, and when we expect that 75% of carbon emissions will come from low-end and middle-income countries by 2050, can you tell us how much passion capital investment that you funded many years ago are having an impact, and how you recently announced, I think, Hardest-to-Reach Initiative can truly expand an affordable energy access market across all those low-income countries in Africa?
Sure, Jean-Philippe, and it actually goes to what we were talking about before, that we're lacking in moral imagination in terms of solving our big problems. We have the solutions as a world. We know how to solve these problems, but the status quo and the types of institutions that we have too often get in the way of allowing those solutions to be extended to people who want to change their own lives. And I think that when we look at electrification, which is SDG 7, electrification for all, it is probably the best example of where we have the technologies, there is deep desire on behalf of individuals, we could solve this problem. We can't solve it with business as usual.
No.
Neither just looking at traditional investment, nor traditional government, nor charity or philanthropy. So it's a great example of what we're talking about in that it's a story that started in 2007 when 1.5 billion people had no access to electricity. Hmm. We made the first patient capital investment in a tiny company called D-Light.
Mm-hmm.
at startup, I would say for the first 7 years, it wasn't clear whether that company would fail or succeed. That patient capital allowed them to have many failures and keep trying. Hmm. And our accompaniment allowed us to bring in talent and access, like I was saying. By 10 years, it was very clear that this not only was a company that succeeded, but it was succeeding because it was building markets that had never existed before. Hmm. People find ways to get themselves energy.
Yeah.
But the energy comes in small amounts of kerosene, which is deadly, dirty, expensive, not good for the planet.
Yeah.
And so what we needed to do was show low-income people that they had a viable alternative. They could pay the same amount of money every day and now have solar, which would be free once it was paid off, and it would improve their income, improve their health, improve their lives. So Acumen continued to invest in about 40 companies that together have brought 230 million people access to electricity off-grid. Solar. Well, it's a dent when you look at $1.5 billion and how one small organization can enable 40 companies to reach a quarter billion people. So that is when we started to think about what would it actually take then to reach SDG 7. And we were able then to look at, first of all, where are the people who don't have electricity?
Yep.
Still today, because now we have about 700 million people. 75% of them live in about two dozen sub-Saharan African nations. We're starting with 16 of them with a very different kind of facility that is unapologetic in the need for patient capital. $50, $60 million of philanthropic backed investment that we can make with a side-by-set debt facility that provides affordable debt and incentives so that if companies actually create impact, they can reduce the interest that they pay to zero. It will still only work with government sponsor, you know, the government has to invite us in. All the lessons that I've learned over these last 40 years, working with other nonprofits that are helping people get access, being cognizant of the security situation in these countries. But what excites me is we have the blueprint. We know how to do it. And so we can go into Somalia and Benin and Chad with very, very low electrification rates. And we can work with entrepreneurs who exist there and people who want to solve their problems. And we can show the world that all these problems are within our reach to solve. We just need the will and the moral imagination because we have the resources, the skills, and we have the technologies.
I love it, Jacqueline, because I think to me it's one of the best concrete examples of what passion capital is all about and driving that kind of impact after many years of super hard work that goes into such initiatives. And already getting a big dent, actually, a quarter of the billion of people is actually quite a significant dent already. But I think not accepting the status quo, as you said rightly, so I love it. Jacqueline is on the front lines of social entrepreneurship, and her story holds valuable lessons for all of us striving to make a meaningful difference in the world. While social entrepreneurs are able to access capital from friends and family or investors to establish proof of concept, they struggle in the later stages. We scale up, where risk capital is more scarce. And that's where Acumen steps in. Their goal is to invest philanthropic capital in companies specifically during these stages. Although it takes on average between 7 to 10 years to get to scale, when they do, social enterprises are truly transformative. No, I know the time is moving pretty fast. I'd love to ask, shift gears a bit and talk about your personal leadership journey, Jacqueline. I'd love to start with mentoring. I think one of your early mentors, John Gardner, that you met in your first business school, played a role in your own development, and so did some other people. In the same context, you know, recently had Indra Nooyi, former CEO of PepsiCo, that you may know as well. And she talked to me about the way she thinks there are two different types of mentors. Mentors that you seek out and mentors that happen more accidentally, organically, that actually those mentors can often pick you. So Can you tell us actually your own experience with mentorship and the superpowers of mentorship that you've had in your life and that maybe your entrepreneurs are getting through Acumen as well today as a result of your experience?
Such a great question. And I haven't fully thought about it, but the way that Indra set it up is really powerful. I think there are those mentors who hold a mirror and maybe show yourself a version that's better than the one that you see in the mirror.
Yeah.
And I actually go back to when I was six and I had this amazing first grade nun, Sister Mary Theophane, who somehow believed that I had come down from heaven. And and she would tell me this. You know, Jacqueline, to whom much is given, much is expected, and you're going to do big things in the world, good things for other people in the world. I think that she planted seeds that I was a little six-year-old kid, but that we don't do this enough. We tell kids they're special snowflakes and that we give them all prizes, but we don't say, I see something in you.
Something Follow very special, that. Very unique.
Follow that thread.
Yes.
And I'm going to hold you with responsibility to it. In Rwanda, which was a very difficult time, as you said, there was a Turkish woman named Bilga Ogun. Amazing. She allowed a level of honesty where I could come and talk about the loneliness and sometimes cry and what it felt like to be fully rejected by sometimes the men in the city, and allowed that level of vulnerability without ever making me feel weak. Help turn it into a strength. And so there's the mentor that allows for that empathetic listening and turning it into a possibility.
Yeah.
John was pure wisdom. John Gardner was walking integrity. He was the role model that I still hold and have a conversation with every day, 20 years after he died. He almost spoke to me, Jean-Philippe, in koans. I would say, I don't know if I should. I got off with this ridiculously big job. John, should I take it? I don't know if I should take it. And he would say, Jacqueline, will this job make you more interesting as a person, or will it allow you to be more interested in the world? And I'd be like, you're killing me.
Wow.
How come I can't ever take a job just to be more interesting? And he'd say, it's your choice. So I think that kind of mentor that doesn't ever give you answers, but asks you the right questions. What they all had in common is they all always let it be known that they had high expectations.
Yes. I usually call those people, Jacqueline, coach, actually. You know, one of our programs in my foundation, we call that coach for good. People who ask you some pretty deep questions, who actually are mostly asking questions as opposed to give any response to your problems, which seems frustrating, but it's not, which are all about empowering and growing others by giving them the chance to reflect, to grow, to learn, to test, to fail, and to build confidence over time. So I love your story. I'd like to talk about another incredible strength I think you have in your leadership story and practice, which is actually the story of storytelling, if I may. And a couple of examples in my podcast episode where I got some great example of that. One, very quickly, was Doug Conan, the former CEO of Campbell's Soup, you know, wrote this great, wonderful book called The Blueprint. And he told me about this moment where, you know, early in his career, he lost his job. He was pretty down. And he met with a consultant. And this consultant gave him the best service. He asked him to write his life story on a couple of pages. And he did that. And then the kind of mentor or a support function actually told him that the way he was telling his story was actually not authentic, was not real. So he gave me a chance to practice his story and to get it right. You know, I was reminded of this story when I read about your fellows program, I think, as well, which support entrepreneurial leaders, because I believe you ask your fellows to do a similar exercise called the River of Life. So I'm not going to go expand too much, but I will let you tell us that. So at the end of the day, you know, I do believe that there's a strength to be developed with positive leaders called how do you build with others? And when you want to build with others, I think it starts by sharing your own experience and your own life story. to talk about who you are, the why you are, and you do what you do, and start building that, you know, really inner confidence with others. Tell us more about your philosophy on life story and the way you believe it's critical actually to develop leaders' confidence with people.
What I loved about what you just said is that it has to come from your own story, your own life. And so the river of life is for all of those individuals who go through Acumen Academy, which is another function at Acumen. We invest in ventures. We also invest in leaders. And we've invested and supported about 1,600 leaders across probably 30 nations now. So to do the river of life, take a piece of paper and literally draw a river. It could just be one line, or you could do two lines, or you might be an artist. And at the different curves, at the bends in the river, write down what happened that had an impact on the many identities that are now inside of you and who you are today and why you lead in the way that you lead. How does that flow come into the person who you are? And inevitably, we all see ourselves in each other's stories, often in each other's suffering. And we realize that the only way we reimagine systems for a world that needs to heal is if we indeed see each other in the one story we can create together, which is our story of shared humanity.
No, that resonates so much with me, Jacqueline, because I had the opportunity for the last 8 years of my life, you know, coaching a few hundreds of young entrepreneurs in my country. And one of the best moments I prefer in those very special, unique moments, one-to-one, coaching moments, or whatever it is those moments where they share their stories deeply. And to me, that's always the revelation moment of what could happen. And coming back to the earlier question about, can I bet actually on this entrepreneur and her to make it happen, to throw and to actually shape that vision, make it work. And that story is so strong when it resonates with those people. So we are almost at an end, but I have a couple more questions I need to ask you about leadership. The life story is an important foundation to me as well, like you, and you talk about it in your manifesto. But there's also, of course, an important piece of work on a shared set of values, right, that you have defined for Acumen, that other change makers or social entrepreneurs have defined for their own organization as well. So would you mind talking to us about your manifesto, your statement of values as well you have, and how you use it to guide decision-making, particularly in the toughest moments of your organization as well, because you have to make those hard calls from time to time.
Yeah, and if you'll indulge me, our manifesto goes like this. It starts by standing with the poor, listening to voices unheard, and recognizing potential where others see despair. It demands investing as a means, not an end. It's the radical idea of creating hope in a cynical world, changing the way the world tackles poverty, and building a world based on dignity. Jean-Philippe, we use it every day.
I can see it. I can feel it.
In investment committee meetings, someone will inevitably say, I was just in an IC meeting where it was an amazing innovation, very, very cool. And the question is, what percentage of low-income people will really be impacted by this? When do you walk away from a donor because it's not the right donor? When do you decide not to partner, even though all of the expectations are that you will partner? And on and on. When you build a culture that has this manifesto at the heart of it, and we revisit it constantly, every Monday morning meeting, we talk about values in action. It really ends up mattering. Yeah.
I think it's super strong because it goes beyond the mission itself. I'm a deep believer in the power of the right mission for any organization. I think it's wonderful to the mission, as again, as a North Star, the compass. I think getting the manifesto is even deeper because it gives you the texture, the sensitivity, the wordings that give you, again, that guide to say no and to say yes and to make those hard decisions. So, almost finishing, Jacqueline, because we could spend hours, of course, together, but I know you're super busy. I'd like you to share some of your secrets because, you know, we've been meeting a couple of times, only this time in another call before, but I saw you in many podcasts, many videos. I tried to watch you. And it's clear, very clear that you irradiate some a lot of positive vibes and energy coming out of yourself. So my question, because it's of course something I'm always trying to learn from my guests, being the host of Positive Leadership, is how do you do that? And can you share that with our listeners? What are the routines, the tips, and more than the tips, of course, because it takes more than tips for Jacqueline to show up every morning, every day, in Rwanda, in New York, somewhere in the world, with that positive energy in yourself and available to give it back to others?
Hmm. Well, first of all, Jean-Philippe, I have to say that you exude positive energy. So I don't think you're here learning all that much, but I really appreciate it. And I appreciate your humility. First of all, Nietzsche said, anyone with a strong why can endure any level of how. Yeah. I think that there's great truth, that if you fully understand why you are here and what you are doing, that in and of itself brings a level that goes beyond commitment. John, my mentor, used to say, commit to something and it will set you free. The second is, I believe deeply in beauty as a part of leadership we don't talk about enough.
Yes.
And going through the Rwandan genocide and losing many, many people and seeing my friends after who had been devastated, I would hear their stories of a level of inhumanity that we're seeing again in the world that made me ashamed. But so would I hear in their stories some of the most extraordinary acts of human kindness and generosity in the middle of a genocide.
Yeah,
yeah. It's always there. I do think it's almost a spiritual practice to pay attention, to look for it.
Yeah.
And that, ironically, allows you to develop a core of steel.
You know, in your book, you suggest having people writing their own manifesto. So as a last question, we've got many listeners now across the world, many countries actually, from Africa as well. We've got some big countries, a lot of listeners in Nigeria as an example, and some others in Tehran, in Iran actually as well, in the US, in UK, etc. You know, as they listen to you, what should they do practically to basically write down their manifesto, to shape their life, their mission in life? What should they do? What's your personal encouragement, coaching to write all manifestos?
Start by listening to yourself. When you think deep about who you are and what you came to do, what is at the essence of that? And it shouldn't be so broad as I'm here to change the world. What drives your curiosity?
Yeah.
And then can I follow the thread of that curiosity? As I follow that thread, what are the values that will drive me and that I want to shape this organization? For Acumen, the most important driver was the idea of investment as a means to solving a problem, not as the end of it in and of itself. I grew up in a world where investment was to make money. And then all the externalities, environmental destruction, excluding people, using people as inputs, that was part of the business. That was not going to be our mission. That was not in our manifesto. In our manifesto, investment was a powerful tool. Capitalism, it has a lot of superpowers. How do we use it in service of solving a problem? Yours will be different. Depending on what your purpose is, then what are the mechanisms that are going to be most useful for you? And then there should be a piece of your manifesto around the how.
Yeah.
What will drive us? See potential where others see despair. Don't be afraid to use words like patience and kindness, resilience and grit. What matters for humility, for listening, for immersion and the moral imagination? Patience and kindness, but also resilience and grit. So what are those values for you? So I would think about it in those three ways: my purpose, my means, and then the values by which I will go after it.
In a world that often seems consumed by profit-driven motives, Jacqueline stands as a beacon of inspiration and a testament to the power of compassion and social impact. Her remarkable journey from Wall Street to the front lines of social entrepreneurship is a captivating story that holds valuable lessons for me personally. And something she said that really resonates with me is, commit to something and it will set you free. We can't know where the path of commitment will take us, but it can serve as a North Star, a guide. Committing yourself to something beyond yourself, of course, is not easy. But nothing of importance is. It requires resilience and grit, and at times, the courage to face rejection. Jacqueline's example may feel like an impossible standard, but all of us have it within us to live a life of purpose. I'm Jean-Philippe Courtois. You've been listening to the Positive Leadership Podcast. I want as many people to listen to this story as possible, and you can help. It makes a huge difference if you could just take a moment to write a review, a comment, and share it with a friend. And if you're looking for more inspiration, head to my LinkedIn page and sign up to my monthly newsletter, Positive Leadership and You. It is packed with tips and recommendations so you can start your own journey of personal growth and positive impact. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.